The lens through which we're looking at that is a life. And the life is that of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, not because it's possible to transfer from one setting and one set of issues and from one life and situation to another, but because Bonhoeffer, as a conscientious Christian, wrestled with those issues and gives provocation for us to do the same. Now, I said yesterday that I was going a little bit stronger on the biography of Bonhoeffer and a little less time for discussion of the issue, which really is the issue for these sessions, in order to finish with that and thereby get to the issue. So today, what I'm going to do to make certain that we get to a discussion of 30 minutes anyway of the issue is I will note that the time is 3 minutes after the hour of 4, and when it is 33 minutes after the hour of 4, I will simply quit. If you hear a semicolon and not a period, you know that that's the reason. All right? We're simply going to quit whether I'm finished or not. And I'll take us as far as we get with the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and then move into that that question, what is genuine Christian patriotism for us as U.S. Americans now? The request is a proper one that today we try to tie the sessions to the remembrance of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I want to begin there with the Bonhoeffer story. It will in some sense be quite indirect. Dietrich Bonhoeffer lived until the 9th of April, 1945. The bomb was dropped on Hiroshima on the 6th of August, 1945, and then 3 days later on Nagasaki. So he did not know that we had entered the nuclear age. But it is only an indirect connection. And there is, again, a fascinating family tie here. Dietrich's oldest brother, Carl Friedrich, was a prominent German physicist and was working on the research of what is, in atomic physics, known as heavy water. When he discerned that his research in physics was probably going to be used as a contribution to the Germans building weapons of mass destruction, Carl Friedrich Bonhoeffer, out of a sense of moral responsibility, not wanting to contribute to the Nazi war effort, changed fields. It was, as did another member of the family, a cousin, one of the von Delbrücks. It was with Carl Friedrich that Dietrich Bonhoeffer made the trip in 1939 to the United States in order to escape the draft as one reason, and then decided at Union Seminary, where he was a guest, that he had to return. Carl Friedrich went on to the University of Chicago as a guest professor in physics. It was at the University of Chicago under the stadium that the first atomic reaction, successful fission reaction, took place. That had nothing to do with Carl Friedrich. There are just these coincidences of family ties and the atomic age. If we were to remember Hiroshima and Nagasaki and make the connection with Bonhoeffer, it would be as a German participating in that war effort. The atomic bomb was originally to be built, to be dropped on Germany. Because of the successful defeat of the Nazis, then the decision was made to drop the bomb on Japan. The war in Europe was over. If one were to remember Bonhoeffer in this connection, one would have to add the symbol of Auschwitz and the concentration camps. Bonhoeffer, because he was in the conspiracy and because the conspiracy was located in the highest echelons of the military intelligence unit, the Abwehr, the Nazi war machine itself, its army intelligence unit was where the conspiracy was headquartered. The right-hand man in the conspiracy was Hans von Dohnányi, brother-in-law of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and the Bonhoeffers all knew about the crimes against humanity taking place in Poland and elsewhere. They knew about what was happening to the Jews. So it would be the mass destruction, indeed the genocide effort, that would have to be included with the symbols of Nagasaki and Hiroshima as an age of mass destruction and real threats of genocide that one would have to gather up as part of memory. And of course Dietrich Bonhoeffer died, and as did Hans von Dohnányi and two others of the Bonhoeffers. Four Bonhoeffer family members were executed for their role in the conspiracy. Incidentally, some of you are fans of the Cleveland Symphony. Christoph von Dohnányi is the conductor now. He's a nephew of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, son of Hans von Dohnányi, and some of the most beautiful letters from an uncle to a nephew are the letters of Dietrich Bonhoeffer to Christoph von Dohnányi about the kind of world that Christoph von Dohnányi was entering. Okay, the last connection that I want to make, and it picks up on where we left the story yesterday, and that is Bonhoeffer's involvement in the ecumenical movement. I finished yesterday with an excerpt from his call to the churches to risk peace. That was a speech at Fanø, Denmark, in 1934. And it was, I did not quote that part of the speech, a call for an international church council of the kind of councils that gave us the great creeds, the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, the Athanasian Creed. That is, the global church would gather to make a statement of what Christians internationally were prepared to do to risk peace. And this is the last connection with Bonhoeffer and our time. I say our time because that very idea has been brought to life again. And Carlfried von Weizsäcker, one of the most prominent German physicists and philosophers, is now heading up a committee to try to gather an international church council for a transnational statement of peace in our time. And his direct inspiration for that is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Actually, the influences go both ways. If you read Bonhoeffer's letters and papers from prison, you'll find that one of the books that is most influential for his own evolving theology is von Weizsäcker's book, The History of Nature and Physics, book. And now the elderly von Weizsäcker, one of the survivors, is picking up the Fanø call for an international church council. Okay, back to 1934, and after my main point here, it is now 13 minutes past the hour. We've got 20 minutes and 10 years to go. My main point is to return to the character of Bonhoeffer's patriotism. I began and ended yesterday by saying that Bonhoeffer died as a Christian for Germany. It is easy to identify him as a Christian patriot. But the ecumenical movement involved Bonhoeffer in international circles, many of them deeply suspect to Germans, in ways which gave Bonhoeffer a question about the kind of patriotism that was his. And he identified himself in the early 30s, first of all, as a citizen of the world church, transcending all national bonds, making up a community of people from all races, classes, and colors. And that relativized his sense of being a German citizen. Nonetheless, it is what I would call, in Bonhoeffer's case, an ecumenical patriotism, because what you see when you observe Bonhoeffer in his ecumenical involvement, is a German speaking who wants to do a couple of things simultaneously. A lot of people didn't understand Bonhoeffer at that time, and he got in trouble about it for that reason. He called the international church to take harsher measures against Germany than it was willing to take, excluding some members, like representatives of the neutral churches and the German Christians. He called for the confessing church to be the only true representative, the opposition church to Hitler, of Germany in ecumenical affairs. The ecumenical movement wasn't prepared to do that. So Bonhoeffer called for stronger anti-Nazi moves than the church was willing to make. At the same time, he called for, he asked for a more sympathetic hearing of Germany's problems and issues, and he thrilled when there were people who could understand the drama and the trauma that Germany was going through. There's a real question whether Bonhoeffer's priorities have shifted from Church Germany to Germany/Church, from patriotism to ecumenism. But Bethke, I think his friends, has it right that it was an ecumenical patriotism that was his, and in Bethke's word, a truth deep in Bonhoeffer's bones was surfaced, namely that a debt had accumulated for every German which had to be paid off. He never forgot the citizenship that he said rises above all national interests. But because a debt had accumulated for every German which had to be paid off, Bonhoeffer now fully identified himself with Germany's destiny and took upon himself a shouldering of responsibility for its crimes. There are moving passages in the book Ethics by Bonhoeffer in the section entitled The Structures of Responsible Life. It all is camouflaged. He dare not write in a way that interprets directly the events of the day. He can't name names. He has to write in the manner of many a theologian and use concepts that are abstract, but it comes down to sharing responsibility for the crimes of one's own nation. So when he talks about bearing guilt, that's what he's talking about in the Ethics. And when he talks about Christ as freeing one to bear the guilt of others, he is talking about that. So even though he's offered in 39 an opportunity to leave the country and safe refuge in the United States, he decides he must return. The privilege of ecumenical refuge has to be set aside for the sake of being an authentically Christian German. Bonhoeffer understood exactly what a later poet from Brazil would write. De More is one of my favorite lines of poetry. It doesn't rhyme, but all poetry doesn't have to rhyme. You can't be universal anywhere except in your own backyard. Now, we come to 17 June 1940. The scene is a cafe. Tables are outdoors. It's in a little town of Memel, Germany. And Eberhard Bethke recalls, "While we were enjoying the sun, there suddenly boomed out from the cafe's loudspeaker the fanfare signal for a special announcement. The message was that France had fallen. The people round at the tables could hardly contain themselves. They jumped up, some even climbed up on the chairs. With outstretched arms, they sang Deutschland, Deutschland über alles and the Horst Wessel song. We had stood up too. Bonhoeffer had raised his arm in the regulation Hitler salute, while I stood there absolutely dazed. Raise your arm! Are you crazy? He whispered to me, and later, we shall have to run risks for very different things now. but not for that salute. That scene is so important because it means that it signals that Bonhoeffer's double life had begun. If you read The Cost of Discipleship, you will note that all Christian witness against evil is to be open, public, above board, clear. Here, however, Bonhoeffer has entered the world of mottled grays and of the conspiracy itself. The seminary director now takes on the grotesque vocation, if you will, of being an agent in Hitler's own army intelligence unit, where the resistance movement is itself headquartered, and the Bonhoeffer family has been deeply involved there, and they asked Dietrich to be hired officially as a courier for the Army Intelligence Unit. What is that? Whatever the military counterpart of the CIA is. And what he is asked to do is use his ecumenical contacts to get messages to the Allies about the resistance strike efforts, and so that France, United States, England will not then further prosecute the war when the resistance makes its effort to overthrow Hitler and the Nazi regime, and just to let them know there is a different Germany trying to be born. And that's what Bonhoeffer did. As a courier then, he traveled abroad to get that word out. He did other things too. He falsified papers to smuggle Jews to Switzerland. Eventually, this would land him in jail. That was a bit of a fluke, and I'm not going to take much more time on this, but Bonhoeffer spent a couple of years in Tegel prison, the military prison, before his part in the conspiracy was discovered. If any of you, well, you don't have to have lived in Washington to understand bureaucratic turf fights, but there was a turf battle between the Gestapo and the Army Intelligence Unit. The Gestapo wanted control of all intelligence activities, and the Army Intelligence Unit said, no, we've got ours, you've got yours, and stay away. But the Gestapo was always looking for an opportunity to do the Army Abwehr, the Army Intelligence Unit, in, and they found that someone hadn't been keeping the books properly on their covert activities. Memos were discovered, which led to suspicion. And the Gestapo then thought they had a case against the military officers who hadn't been keeping the books right and had been careless with their memos. And they arrested Bonhoeffer and some others on that basis. The case was never proven in Bonhoeffer's instance, but in Germany you sat in jail until you were proven innocent, and that was a couple of years. Hans von Dohnanyi was also taken there. I'll read you two sections of a poem. It's in the book, Letters and Papers from Prison. It's entitled Night Voices from Tegel. It's a very long poem. It gives you some idea of what it is for a citizen, a patriot of high bourgeois standing, a German who was schooled in civil responsibility, what it feels like to be involved in covert activity to overthrow the government of one's own nation. And remember now that this is not only covert activity. Bonhoeffer has to act like a Nazi. That is utterly repulsive to him. So you have that reflected in such stanzas as this. We too had learned to lie before long and adapted ourselves to public wrong. And when the defenseless were felled by force, we took it all as a matter of course. That's a reference to Jews being gassed, and he knows it. And that which within our hearts still flamed remained unspoken and unnamed. We checked the blood's insurgent flow and trampled out the inward blow. It killed us, inside as well as outside. We have been witnesses of silent deeds. Is there any way back to simplicity and honesty? He asks in the essay for his friends, published as After 10 Years. I'm just trying to convey to you that along with this sense of patriotism, this identification with Germany's fate, comes great emotional and moral turbulence. And the times were surreal to start with, and they became more surreal for someone like Bonhoeffer in those kinds of conspiratorial circles. Yet he remained clear-headed. One time in one of these trips to Switzerland, in this case, for the resistance, he met with Visser Tuft, the World Council of Churches wasn't organized until 1948 at Amsterdam, but its predecessor units were already in order, and the great states person of the World Council of Churches was already on the scene, Visser Tuft, and Bonhoeffer became a friend of this Dutchman. Visser Tuft, in one of their meetings in Geneva, asked Dietrich, for what do you pray these days? And Dietrich replied, regrettably, I must pray for the defeat of my nation. I said Bonhoeffer remained clear-headed. I say that because it's only in retrospect that we can really judge the Germans to have been somehow swept away in a mania fueled by Nazism. It wasn't clear to the Germans where things were headed, and the vast majority welcomed the 30s as deliverance from the meles of the Weimar Republic and deliverance from the runaway inflation and unemployment of the Depression. There was a mighty surge of national pride in the early 30s, and there was a new power and prestige and prosperity that supported that national pride. Even those who became anti-Nazi Christian heroes drank the heady brew of those years. Martin Niemöller rejoiced that Germany was back and standing tall after the national humiliation of the previous war and the shameful defeat and the terms of defeat. With almost everyone else, Martin Niemöller was feeling good about being German. Bonhoeffer wrote to his Swiss friend, Erwin Sutz, friend from Union, ingenuous visionaries like Niemöller still go on thinking they're the true National Socialists, which was the claim that Niemöller made early on. Well, it wasn't long before the folly and the evil of militant racist nationalism displayed its wares, and the slow, sure doom fell pitiless and dark upon Germany. And Bonhoeffer remained clear-headed, as did the whole family, through those years. But it meant a change. It meant a change theologically and morally from a sharp, unequivocal protest above board in opposition to Nazism to the figure of a kind of alley figure, meetings in dark places, the terrible patriotism of conspiracy. Bonhoeffer, earlier in the Cost of Discipleship and in the early 30s, had a kind of countercultural Jesus who was to be followed, highly visible in bright evangelical witness. But the Jesus of the letters and papers from prison and of the ethics becomes a Jesus of sorrows, the one for others who never speaks, but only in dreadful silence takes upon himself the guilt of others. It's almost, if some of you know Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor, the Jesus there who never says a word, but only kisses the Grand Inquisitor is the kind of Jesus that shows up in the letters and papers from prison. And that same identification with Jesus that had led Bonhoeffer to say no to the patriotism of flags and party rallies and the Berlin Olympics in 1936, where he made a speech against what was happening in the country, now led him to say yes to another and very different kind of love of country. To be a Christian, Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote in among his last letters, is to stand by God in God's hour of grieving. It's an absolutely moving and stunning definition of what it means to be a Christian. To stand by God in God's hour of grieving. And God was grieving in Germany. As a German, Bonhoeffer had to be there, and like Jesus, he had to drink the earthly cup to the dregs. So, I have 4 minutes. What is Christian patriotism? I'm just going to recall what it was for Dietrich Bonhoeffer and use that summary as a just jumping off place for our discussion. 4 marks, maybe. Bonhoeffer, as a Christian patriot, was one, a grateful heir, a genuine guardian of his own country's cultural wealth. He was a self-conscious conservator of what he regarded as the best that Germany had to offer. I suggest to you the letters and papers from prison, the sermon written from jail for the baptism of his namesake, Dietrich Wilhelm Rüdiger Bethke, in which Bonhoeffer talks about the legacy that is young Dietrich Bethke's legacies that he hopes will be nurtured in the future generation. He was a conservator of the best of the past and a guardian of it, and that was what a patriot should be, a grateful heir and a guardian. 2, through experiences with others unlike him, underline, unlike, at home and abroad, he entered into their lives sufficiently to view his own nation from what were for the nation and himself, external and marginal points of view. From other people's experience, he saw Germany afresh, one nation amid a world of nations. And so patriotism, in the second instance, is to see one's own nation from the point of view of other nations, and to enter into their experience in order to do so for oneself. Thirdly, he worked vigorously in the international church and in the resisting church in Germany. He represented his own country's legitimate aspirations and strengths in transnational church circles, and he offered the perspectives and gifts of non-German Christians to his home church. His patriotism was always qualified and instructed by the cosmopolitanism of the body of Christ. He never regarded himself as a Christian patriot except as looking at his own nation by virtue of being a member of a transnational reality, the body of Christ. There's a wonderful little thing. We have Bonhoeffer stories around the seminary to this day. And one of them is that Dietrich, when he was in a class and it came his turn in the seminar to lead the session for the day, told the Americans, with whom he was not impressed as theologians, "You'll have to forget everything you know about theology to understand what's coming next." He wasn't worried that that was a whole lot. But he wanted them to clear the decks because they had not heard of Karl Barth before, and Karl Barth was the rising theologian. So they had to remember all that. You wouldn't have known from that little episode or many others that he had thought Americans had anything to contribute to German theology. Well, he got back to Finkenwalde later on when he was director of the seminary and chief professor, virtually the only one, there. What does he do? He not only tells them they got to get with it, the social gospel movement, which Germans hadn't heard of, but he plays black American music as a spirituality they ought to learn and take seriously. So there's this nice example that his patriotism is very strong. He knows he's a German, but it's always qualified by what he can learn by way of the cosmopolitan character of the international church. And then finally, he identified with those Germans, some of them Christian, many of them not. He worked with socialists and communists in the resistance as well. Some of them Christian, many of them not, who risk all in an attempt to save their country from utter destruction and further unrelieved guilt from even more crimes against humanity. And in this solidarity, he died as an ecumenical for Germany. Whatever else this Christian patriotism is, it is a profound acceptance in the sense of to take on, to receive willingly. What is taken on as one's own are both the culture, the society's gifts to cherish, to pass on, but what is taken on also is a deep sense of moral responsibility for the crimes and the victims of one's own nation, and a calling to atone for those and to deter, to prevent further victims' crimes. I would say it's community, solidarity, and sacrifice that Bonhoeffer lifts up, as well as conservation of gifts, which characterize his patriotism. Finally, then, to be quick where I began, the poem where he sees himself identified as Moses, only now his people are the Germans, one of the last pieces from Dietrich Bonhoeffer's pen. God, I have loved this people, that I bore its shame and its sacrifices, and have seen its salvation. That is enough. Okay. It's not an easy transition to move from a figure as touching and as moving as Dietrich Bonhoeffer into the issues that face us directly some 40 and 50 years later. But the issues are there. Many of them are similar. And I don't know exactly where to begin other than with the question of what would you see as qualities of genuine patriotism for us in our setting as United States citizens, and keeping in mind the qualification that Bonhoeffer lifts up so well, qualification of what it would be to be a Christian patriot. Who wants to go? I have no worry that we'll get a good discussion. I just want someone to get it started. That's all.
I'm worried about the term patriotism.
Oh, yeah.
It's now a product of the same kind of cynicism that's born out of the Vietnamese War, type of flaunting of our nation as being privileged in the world. And I know that just connotatively the term is in trouble. And I've seen some of that reinforced through the discussion of Bonhoeffer, the cultural elitism. I've as a visitor of Germany, encountered a few times.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, we're all suckers when it comes to German culture because we just inherited so much of it. But it still hurts a little, you know, when you find a real elite German rubbing it in. And so that hasn't helped the term in my mind. And so I guess the first thing I'd throw out, Larry, is do we have a usable term, or is it one that should be really strongly qualified or replaced in a world that I don't think can tolerate much patriotism, at least if it's in a tribalistic sense that we understand the term?
That's a very probing question. It may be that our situation is so different from Bonhoeffer's. He sensed a coming age, but didn't live in it. And it may be that our time is such that it's either become one world and have our strongest sense of identity as members of the single world, or die. I mean, or like you say, the tribalisms can be tolerated less and less. I don't want that to end the discussion, however.
It's an open-ended question. I'm really not
Mark.
One thing that struck me as you went through the issues, and in a way I'm bouncing off what Paul said, if Oliver North were sitting in this group with his sincere Christian beliefs, his sincere patriotism, and his feeling that the nation was going in the wrong direction, it was necessary for him to step in and act unilaterally, would he find a great hero in Deacon Bonhoeffer?
Hmm. Mm-hmm. That is certainly part of the modeled gray. That requires a long answer, which we better not give, but a short answer is to be found in the ethics itself of Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer undertook this bold move where a small group of people decided that they better represented Germany's interests than did the officials in power, that is, the Nazis. He undertook that with fear and trembling, and what he says in the limited justification he does give to it is that it can only be understood as a highly exceptional act, and he finally throws himself into the arms of God and for mercy. That is, it's a eulogistic reading of history rather than a triumphalist one. It is a remove of repentance and atonement rather than a move which says we are furthering a great international cause and defending the world. I mean, if you wanted to line up the mood about it and the defense of it, you'd have very contrasting pictures. Oliver North insisted that what he did was right, and to this day regards it as right, as well as not unlawful. Bonhoeffer has the most turbulent kind of questions about it and wants somehow to get past this event and get back to something much more normal. It is not a part. Bonhoeffer's is not a crusade. Is not a crusade. So I think that part of it is very, very different. But there is that appropriation to a small group to be speaking for the national interest without checking in with everyone else. That's no doubt about that. The accountability of power issue is one where you would see some parallels, or non-accountability in Oliver North's case.
I heard a joke about it. Somebody said Oliver North ought to run for president, and somebody else said, too late, he already has been. I did that to stir up fun.
See.
Larry?
Yes.
Robert McAfee Brown, in his little book that came out not too long ago called Saying Yes, Saying No, he says that the great failure of the church in Nazi Germany was that overall it was so enculturated into the dominant society that it had no independence of vision and action, and that even those people who finally resisted did so too late, meaning that their only choice was martyrdom. And what he says is that while we can't jump directly from Nazi Germany to the United States, that the signs of national idolatry are everywhere present. In the policy in Nicaragua, in the government invasion of privacy of the churches, and he has a very long list that we could probably add to. I wonder how real you think that parallel is and how real other people think that parallel is. And he says, if we don't act now, we invariably will end up in a similar situation if we don't learn that lesson.
Jack, I'm glad to comment on that and invite the responses of others as well. The first part of the assessment, that German churches were too acculturated to provide an independent basis of resistance in the society, even though they were some of the logical institutions for that, is true, and it was Bonhoeffer's observation that that was the case from the start. Even the confessing church itself, which was the small portion of the larger church in Germany which resisted Nazism and set up its own independent base, never got past the German nationalism that affected its own ranks. And it refused to come across as not supporting Germany, and refused to come across in ways also that, well, it refused, it worried about being tagged as communism. I don't know if you recall this or not, but Hitler's early campaigns were campaigns that not only raised the specter of the Jews, but raised the specter of the communists. And the concentration camps were built in the first instance for German socialists and communists. And the confessing church itself maintained strong nationalist and strong anti-communist themes for fear of being perceived as unpatriotic. Dietrich Bonhoeffer's seminary at Finkenwalde lost in its membership a full one-third of the student body, as they died as soldiers. That's how deeply impressed they were with his efforts at pacifism and nonviolence. It just was not something that had a basis in Germany, even in the most resisting parts of the church. Yeah, the acculturation goes very deeply. Bob Brown's second part of that assessment, namely that they really had, their choices were pretty early run out, and that about all that was left was the resistance that leads to martyrdom, is also true. When the 50th anniversary of the Barman Declaration was celebrated, that would be about 2 years ago, right? No, 84. The Barman Declaration is the founding of the Confessing Church. Eberhard Bethke, who has lived through all of those events, said, "We thought that to confess was to resist. What we didn't learn early enough was that to resist is to confess." And what he meant by that is, we thought that by speaking out against what was going on in Germany, including speaking out for the Jews, that that was sufficient resistance in the form that was proper for the church to take as resistance. What we needed to learn yet was that to resist in more active ways was to confess. Bonhoeffer himself said, "The first and the last act of confession is the deed itself." So that's true. I would conclude in general, Jack, that any country which claims an openness to democratic possibilities, where the churches do not take up in an active way their resistance early on in the forms that a democracy permits, has closed itself down for the times when it is no longer possible to protest and to resist in democratic forms. If you don't use those means early on, then you're not in a position, usually, to use those effective means when it becomes less possible to move around, to make the networks, to be a public base for another way of being and doing. And that happened in Germany. It had relatively few openings to start with, but by the time it became a totalitarian state, after about 38, then the means were so severely limited, and the churches had to do mostly rescue stuff. Confessing Church was never involved in the conspiracy as such, except by members like Bonhoeffer. Confessing Church ended up having to do things like trying to save a few Jews, trying to help others from the worst, keep them out of concentration camps, and so on. Now, well, let me open it up. There's another part of the question, that is, you asked about the parallels. Yeah,
I can think of one. We just saw a slide over in the PC, in the Village Center, where the Americans in, was it in Nicaragua? And they were, once a week, they parade in the street and say, please do not come and rescue us here to the United States. And so in advance of being rescued like they did in Grenada, they parade in the street. About 200 of them do that once a week to tell the United States not to come and rescue them down there. I mean, this is really bizarre. But I know they're very afraid that the United States is going to go down there and invade that country. And in fact, the United States has been in there, and they have good reason to think that. I think, as an American, I think that that we're close to going down and going in there.
It seems to me that once a country goes to war, as Germany did at some time, a lot of powers are suspended.
Yes.
We have a free press, and we aren't engaged in war. And there are a lot of things that the Nazi government could get away with because they were at war, that our government has no intention of doing or getting away with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we, as long as we have a strong and free press, there is no parallel between what the kinds of information that were withheld from the German people. Even though Dietrich and his family may have known about the Jews, I would say in general, most Germans ignored it, or at least wanted to believe something different that was happening.
Yes, yeah. And certainly we're subject to a controlled press. No question about it. Yeah. And another non-parallel is that you simply didn't have among the Germans a history of grassroots organization of something other than what came down the chain of command. I mean, U.S. American society has a lively sense of volunteerism. To network, to organize. That has come about in Germany now, but it was not the case in the first half of the century. Yeah. There, comment over here, wasn't it? Yes.
Well, yeah, somebody may remember it more accurately than I do, but in a recent advertisement of Sojourners, they have this quote of one of the generals in the Pentagon at some staff meetings, saying that what we have to be, what we, the people in the committee, have to be concerned about now is what's going on in the churches in this country. So I don't know if it's quite accurate to say that the government has no intention or desire to censor some of the things that are, let's say, being discussed and talked about here. I think that the whole business of disinformation campaigns, et cetera, really quite contrary.
Yeah. Jim Wallace, who is the chief editor of Sojourn, loves to parade that quotation around, too. He just loves that one. He uses it every chance he can get. It's true. It's a true quotation. The reference is in part because the churches were so involved in two different campaigns. One is that the churches provided an independent source of information from Central America. And the second is that the churches were involved, not usually officially as denominations, but church people involved in the Freeze campaign. And the reference, the meeting at the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was in the context of those two independent, but possibly merged movements.
I think it's problematic whether or not, at this point, normal legislative processes will turn us around from what Richard Falk calls nuclearism.
Mm-hmm.
There may still be democratic paths that can be taken, but they may be more in terms of civil protest, civil disobedience. I sometimes wonder if legislative action is going to do it now. Because for 40 years we've been steeped in this idea that nuclear weapons are the key to our safety and survival as a nation.
I'd like to make a comment about the nuclear arms race as well. We think in the past, we don't think, as Einstein would like us to think, in a new way. We still think in the past in terms of nonviolence or violence. Mm-hmm. And yet, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, the choice isn't between nonviolence and violence. Now the choice is between nonviolence and non-existence.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we start thinking that way, we have to work at conflict resolution in nonviolent ways.
Yeah.
And we're not thinking that way.
Yeah. No.
We're in a nuclear age, and we're thinking old patterns of thinking.
Yeah. One of the non-parallels, which also concerns me deeply, is that in the German situation you had both reasons for protesting and for a different understanding of patriotism, a la people like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, because of what was happening within the country as well as what was happening in the country's name abroad. I find our situation as U.S. citizens, in a sense, almost more difficult, because it becomes the real possibility that we can have the formal arrangements of democracy at home. We can vote, we can write letters to our congresspeople, we can elect our representatives, etc. And thus, have the channels for influence in that way as secured by formal democratic arrangements. And at the same time, we can, as a democracy which is a great superpower, be doing all sorts of things which result in people abroad being victims. That's how to be a patriot in the way that I see Bonhoeffer, that is trying to enter into the reality of those on the other end of the stick from us is tough.
Can you look at that more specifically, Larry? I think, you know, if that's true, that's a very important new dimension that needs looked at. Is this because of multinational corporations that somehow locate themselves between national laws? Is it in part because of the incredible amount of authority that's vested in non-congressionally regulated departments and operations, whether it's military or the presidential office? Can you explain why it is that we've got this government alongside another government?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, other people have chunks of the answer to that. I certainly don't have. But it's not only that the formal democratic structures themselves haven't resulted in the distribution of power among the people. That is, you've got great concentrations of power alongside or outside such arrangements. Most of it's economic. not entirely so. Or it's in the name of the democracy as a great military power, but runs according to some of its own rules. I have a close friend, we're talking about lieutenant colonels, one of my friends is a lieutenant colonel, and he is an ardent patriot of, I'm not going to call it an old-fashioned sort, of the common sort, probably defending Ollie North these days. But it's always fun to talk to him because he's readily ready to admit that the Pentagon's economy is a socialist economy. And he, as a member of the military, is cared for, you know, as long as in every detail of life. There isn't a whole lot of competition there. It's an independent, semi-independent operation, and he's well aware of that as a career military person. But those are not the, and then thirdly, it is deeply disturbing in the Iran-Contra affair that what we have here is the unaccountability of power. And we have it done in the name of our national interests. And if there's anything suspicious about it, that we ought to be suspicious about, first of all, as Christians, we ought to have a deep biblical suspicion about unaccountable power. But as citizens, we better have too, because democracy insists that if you've got anything at all, it's the accountability of power. But it isn't only that, Paul. National, international dimensions are complicated by the fact, as Reinhold Niebuhr said, that foreign policy is the Achilles heel of democracy. That is, democracy runs on our ability to represent our own interests and trusts that we can represent our own interests well, and that we have a stake in them. Because we have a stake in them, we will see that our own interests are voiced and heard, and we have a way to check if they are not heard and responded to. But foreign policy, you're asking people here to represent other people's interests and somehow take that into account. And what gets projected instead, as Niebuhr said, is not the interests of other people. What you get is the collective interests of the nation there. Well, we're about finished. Are we about to begin? I'm not sure. I'm not satisfied with where we are. I think we need to talk about what is genuine patriotism for ourselves in this kind of world. I think we've only scratched a little bit of the surface. We're sort of probing at the character of our setting, but we haven't yet probe the character of our response.
Perhaps this evening's forum may get a little farther along that road.
That's fine, and I hope that's the case. The topic of the forum is Christian obligation or option, or some civil disobedience. I myself want to and will be there. If I think back upon the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, that is unsettling to me as a way of focusing the question of patriotism. One of the, not because it's not an important question, not because the times aren't times which make the question appropriate, but one of the striking things in the letters and papers from prison is the fact that you've got someone who ought to be obsessed with the troubles of the time. And instead of being obsessed with the troubles of the time and letting them focus his entire life, he has an ability to see life whole. And he has an ability to talk about powers of good. And I'm only a little bit concerned about that as a definitional question to talk about patriotism, because I think it puts the question of patriotism at the point of moral quandary, when we ought to define patriotism in terms of a wider understanding of what is the good that we seek to be and to represent, instead of only In other words, don't always focus on problems and solutions. Focus on what is the positive Christian calling and what are some of the positive possibilities that our life and our society provides for us as well. But thank you for your presence and participation.